Hey, this is James from StrivalPunk.com. I've got what should be a fun episode today that will make you think about some things. Not quite like last episode made you think about things, where the last episode, the Antifa or fascist episodes, probably made you think about punching people in the face. Because it did me. They have really made me angry, so if you haven't listened to that episode, please go back and check it out. I think you will enjoy it. This week, though, we're going to talk about high-tech survival versus primitive survival. And which should you focus on? And if you've listened to the show for a while, you probably know my stance. But let's find out. So, well, which one should you focus on? You need to probably split your resources in a little bit of both. You know, there's a lot of area to pick and choose. And some people do tend to go all in, or at least mostly all in. They tend to favor one, you know, over the other, either high-tech survival or primitive survival. And that's fine. My balance number is probably a bit on the high-tech side over the primitive side, but I have a lot of love for the primitive side. You know, I've gone to primitive skills gatherings, had a good time there, but I haven't done a whole ton of the skills there. So let's go over them and so basically this episode is going to be a sort of an example list of what the skills are and a comparison. So you can be like, well, this is this and this is this. So it should be fun and it should give you some ideas and make you think about some things. So let's start with primitive because it came first. So with the primitives, you have your primitive fire, hand drill, bow drill, fire plow, which I've not tried. I have tried and I've used the hand drill and bow drill. You know, it is what it is. Flint and steel, I've used that. It's not the hardest one on this list, I'll tell you that. But it's kind of finicky. So, you know, with that, I think it's a pride of a mark of pride as a survivalist to be able to make a hand drill fire, and they are hard. It's some of these videos you see on YouTube, people just walk out in the woods and they just grab a stick here and a stick there and you know, there's their fire. Most of that's bullshit. Most of it is bullshit. You know, a lot of times people will they'll go out and they'll spend a lot of time finding the right wood, and they'll keep that, and they'll keep it inside where it's nice and dry and warm, so that it is the driest material they can get to do. So it's I don't know, I feel like some of the YouTube videos kind of put out like information that's not as accurate as it could be to make and people are like, I wonder why I can't ever get one started, and I was going on. Well, it's probably that, you know, unless you are the ancient caveman that did this every day, walking out in the woods and finding the perfect set for your hand drill fire set, you know, just in minutes is probably not going to happen. I myself waited a while until I saw some dead mullein stalks and then grabbed one, prepared it, brought it inside, and that's where it lives. A dead mullein stalk is my spindle. So, and then I still need a good new hearth board. So it's, or you can go on Kickstarter where some dude's selling a pre-made hand drill set for some ridiculous amount of money. It's like dowel rod, cedar hearth board, something, something. It's like, what? Come get out of here. I have thought, though, that you could probably just go to the hardware store and get a piece of dowel rod and a softer piece of hearth board and, you know, for practice, actually, that would probably be for the, to get your hands used to the motion and whatnot. That would not be a bad idea. And I mean, a fire is a fire. If you got the materials from the wild or you got them from Lowe's, you still made a fire, you know, with your hands. So I wouldn't fault you. I've thought about it and might do it actually. So there is value in knowing the right materials to use to make a hand drill, though. So, you know, it's worth looking at. It's a huge topic, and if you want to go down that road, then there are some good YouTube videos. You know, you got to kind of be picky about it, and I met a guy at Permanent Skills Gathering who literally wrote a book on hand drill fires. No, I don't mean like a pamphlet. Like, he wrote a book on them, and the dude could make a hand drill fire. So, you know, might be worth picking up. Of those, it would not be bad to have a flint and steel kit. You know, I love ferro rods, and we'll talk about them a bit later in the modern survival. You know, but just, I mean, it's the flint and steel is so simple and so renewable. I mean, you know, a ferro rod will eventually run out. I mean, I don't think I've ever used one completely, though. I've lost a few, but I don't think I've used one all the way through. You know, and if you go camping and you can restart the next fire from the coals of the first fire, then, you know, you really only need to use it like a few times, you know. It's not that bad. So, flint steel, though, you just have to find more flint. And by flint, I just mean a rock of a certain hardness. I think over 7, I might be wrong on the geo rock hardness scale. I'm not a rock person. But yeah, I mean, you just go around hitting rocks, and then if it shoots sparks, hey, that rock has a hard enough, you know, hardness. So, and, you know, it's so small, it doesn't take up that much space. Just throw a steel in your fire kit. Because, you know, I want as many things in my fire kit to make fire and keep fire as possible. You know, with reason, you know, I don't want to carry a, you know, a pack mule for my fire kit. But I do tend to put fire very high on my list of things to keep in my bug out bag and my survival kits. You know, the quality and just the redundancy in my fire kit tend to be a bit more than some of the other things. Primitive shelters. You know, this is just a fun one, like building a primitive shelter. I've built several primitive shelters. We'll probably build several more. You know, and I can remember back, like, when I was a kid, like, 8, 7, 8, 9, somewhere in there, maybe somewhere. Just went out in my backyard and started, like, snapping, like, tree branches and twigs off of trees, you know, in the summertime. and I built this little hut. You know, I just it wasn't like the most secure thing, but you know, I just sort of stuck some branches in the dirt to make, you know, my walls, and then, you know, thatched the roof. And you know, it certainly wasn't anything like the YouTube channel Primitive Survival or Primitive Technologies. I mean, that dude's a genius, but you know, four walls and a roof, and you know, we went inside and played caveman or whatever we were doing. I don't know, me and my brothers. But yeah, primitive shelters are fun. I mean, they take time and they take some knowledge, but some of it I just kind of feel like it's ingrained in our human DNA. Like we just like instinctively kind of know how to build a shelter. You know, you could see pictures and whatnot, and you just get out there and you just like that autopilot kicks on and you just start building a shelter. So I enjoy it. I've built some lean-tos and some debris huts over the years, and I kind of want to build like something a lot bigger, a lot neater. Like those super survival shelters, the hexagons with the stacked woods and stuff. Like they interest me, and probably gonna do something this summer. Probably gonna build some sort of shelter this summer, and there'll be a YouTube video on the Survival Punk YouTube channel. It's definitely one of those skills. Like I feel that like this is like one of the primitive skills that you probably should learn. You know, if you are ever lost, you know, dying of exposure is one of the fastest things. So practicing and knowing primitive shelters, definitely add that to your list. Practice. Yes, like I said, you go into that autopilot mode, but the better you are at it, the faster it'll go. Because if you're trying to build a survival shelter in bad conditions, you know, you're going to fall back to, you know, what you've practiced. And the faster you can get that done, the faster you can get out of the elements, the better your chances of survivability are. So practice. And you know, in most cases, I would just suggest a simple like lean-to. You find a wide branch, you jam it against a tree, and then you add some walls to it. And technically, you can add another wall to enclose it completely, and then cover it with lots of debris, and then sort of like shimmy your way in. You know, that'll probably offer you about the most warmth you can get, and make sure you don't aim the hole, your shimmying entrance hole, towards the wind. Because then you're just making, like, a cold sack. I mean, you're just, that's not going to be good. So, there are so many, like, nuances to shelter building. It could probably be an entire episode. You know? Like, really, you want to find the most level ground you can get. And if you can't find perfectly level ground, you at least want your head elevated above your feet. One, it'll rush the blood to your head, and that's not good. And humans just don't really find that comfortable. You will not get a good night's sleep. You know, and if you're trying to figure out why you couldn't sleep and your feet are above your head like that the whole night, you're not going to sleep. Sometimes in a hammock, your feet can be a bit above your head, but it's a weird bend, and it's not quite a true like horizontal elevation. It's not all vertical. Your feet are up, but then your torso's down, and then your head's a little up. But if you sleep in a hammock correctly, that's mostly eliminated. It's not like bent in. Some people. We're going off on a tangent here. Some people, I've seen them comment on like hammock stuff. And they're like, that can't possibly be good for your back being bent like that all the time. And it's like, people are just parroting things that they've heard and seen, and they don't really understand that, no, your back will not hurt in a hammock if you've slept in it properly. That's just all there is to it. You know, if you sleep at like a 45-degree angle in any modern camping hammock, you are sleeping damn near flat. My Hennessy hammock, I can roll around in that thing. It's so flat. And if you try to roll around in, you know, I mean, can you even, like, that bent shape that you got when what people think what they sleep in a hammock, you can't roll around. You can't bend sideways that much. Like, you would just snap your spine. So, rant of the day over. next is flint napping. This is one that I've been interested in, and I've meant to put together a flint napping kit. I just haven't got around to it yet. You know, there's only so much time that you have in a day, and I have a lot of interests and hobbies, and I haven't got around to flint napping, nor have I got around to the ham radio. I got a book on ham radio one time, and I started to read it. My eyes glazed over, and it was the most boringly written piece of information I've ever tried to read. And I was like, nope, I'm done. People have told me repeatedly to just go take that exam that gives you all the questions and memorize all the questions, then go take the test. Memorize all the questions, go take the test. And just get your license just so you can play with it. I've thought about that. I've thought about buying the ham radio, learning how to use it, not talking on it, keeping it for emergencies. I mean, super emergency, like, should I set the fan? Let's have the ham radio. And I've thought about that, and I'm going to do that eventually. I may get my ham license. I will definitely get a ham radio. I've planned that if the shit hits the fan, and it's not super bad to total totalitarian government will kill me. I think I may still broadcast the podcast on ham radio, which kind of makes me think back to the Christian Slater movie, Guerrilla Radio, Pirate Radio. Turn Up the Volume. That's what it was. He ran a pirate radio station. Yeah. Good movie when Christian Slater had hair and did movies, which he doesn't anymore. Anyway, flint napping. You know, it's not even a super steep curve to get into. Like, I have not really seen a lot of flint here in Tennessee. We must have rocks that are flint nappable. That's a word. Because Tennessee had a fairly large Native American presence historically. And I'm sure I've seen arrowheads. I've found arrowheads here. And I don't know what the rock was, but we have some sort of rock that is nappable. You can't nap all rocks, from what I understand. You can nap the bottoms of glass bottles, though. Most glass bottles, not all glass bottles. Some work better for this. Your mileage may vary. There are a lot of good YouTube videos on this, and it would be a good place to start. So, I mean, with that, finding free glass to use to just pop the bottom out. If you've seen Couch Potato Mike's video that he stole the idea from me, playfully, I showed him the trick years ago. We've both done it back and forth where you just fill up a glass bottle, like a beer bottle, almost all the way up, like somewhere around the neck, and then you bop it with your hand. It just pops the bottom off of it. I've seen another YouTube video after that that if you use a rubber mallet and you just lightly bop it, you'll just break the glass off. Because sometimes, depending on the bottle, you'll hurt your hand. Anyway, like I said, it's you really kind of need minimal things to get started. And if you go glass, then, I mean, one, you have almost an endless resource. There's glass balls everywhere. Like, it's a weird thing that if you walk out into some woods, there's always, like, just a glass pile. Now, I don't understand it. But almost every time I've walked around woods, I've seen, like, some glass bottles. But often, like, they'll congregate a pile of glass bottles. Like, that was the drinking spot back in the 20s. Like, you walk out in the woods and you put down your bottle there. Because a lot of times it is older glass bottles. So, it's weird. Primitive weapons and traps. So, this is another fun one that is definitely worth putting a little bit of time into. There are a lot of primitive weapons. You can cobble together a primitive bow fairly easily. You can get really sophisticated with it. I've had a few friends, and I've seen people take longbow courses where, like at the primitive skills gatherings and whatnot, they would have longbow blanks, and they would carve them out to finish over the course of the week. You know, at the end, they would have themselves a longbow, you know, that would then need to be, I think the wood was seasoned, so I think it didn't really need to dry, but you also, you know, I think, no, it was dry, I think. I didn't take the course, so I don't know, but I'm pretty sure it was dry, and, you know, they would carve it down and work it throughout the week, and then finish it, and then you would have a longbow at the end of the week. So, you know, and I've seen people on YouTube basically just lash together three pieces of wood, you know, a centerpiece, and then two bow arms on either side, and then lash it up, and then they shot arrows. You know, there are a lot of ways to make a bendy piece of material with string fling an arrow. The Mongolians, I believe, used yak horn. Like, they would bend yak horn. I don't know if that was the entire structure of the bow, or if they used two yak horns and, like, a center piece of wood, but, because, you know, on the steppe where they were from, there was not a total lot of trees. It was kind of the desert, you know, shrub bushery. So they had lots of horn to use. You know, you will adapt and figure out a way to make it. The PVC pipes people are making now, those are really neat. And I especially like the simplest of them, like, where it's PVC pipe with, trail marker signs, road sign, hold on, a brain fart. They're just fiberglass poles jammed on the inside, you know, in certain, like, there's, like, more in the center and then less out towards the ends, and that keeps it rigid, because otherwise, a lot of the PVC pipes I've seen without that fiberglass core in it, they don't seem to have, like, the longevity. And there's less of a pull on those, because it's just PVC pipe. Like, you can only pull it so hard, and it can only spring with so much force. Fiberglass resin cores, though, you get a lot more pull, and you can get a pretty good, you know, you can get a pretty good, you know, shoot on that. So, that's the way to go. But that's not truly primitive. So, that would be for the modern survival. So yeah, you can cobble together a bow. There are atlatls, and that's I like the word atlatl, and I've been thinking about making an atlatl recently, which is, if you don't know, and some of you may not know, it's basically a stick with like a hollowed out receptacle on one end to accept a dart. So, you know, I'm not saying an arrow, but basically it's an arrow. Or you could just, you know, we'll just call it a dart. And you use that to fling it. So when you put it in there, it makes like a seven shape. It has that angle in it where, you know, your stick is going one way and then the dart is coming straight out of the end of it to make that right angle there. And when you flick it and you follow through, you just like you're throwing a baseball, you throw it from, you know, I'm not an atlatl expert. There is a guy, I think his name is Atlatl Bob. He goes to primitive gatherings. When you throw it, it would release, the inertia from flinging the atlatl stick would release it at the optimal point where you get to it. Alarm's going off. I wonder if you guys can hear that or if you just think I'm crazy. It would, when you aim it at that pinnacle point there where your arm is straight and the dart is pointing towards your target, it would release and you would keep going because that carry through affects, you know, how hard you go. Like when you, like golf or baseball, when you throw a baseball, you don't stop your arm at the point where you release the ball. You continue through its arc, and that imparts more kinetic energy to your thing you're throwing. So yeah, same thing with the atlatl. You want to keep going through, follow through. Your dart goes forward, hits your target. It is not... I'm explaining this and I'm like, this is a topic for YouTube and not for a podcast. Because if you've not ever seen atlatl, go, if you're driving, do not look it up right now. But when you get to a place where you can, check it out. Look on YouTube, just atlatl. And God knows if you butcher that word, YouTube will be like, bro, I got you. This is what you're looking for. You'll find it. Yeah, so that's another primitive weapon, just a stick, just a heavy throwing stick, you know, not too long, you know, somewhere in the 1.5-2 feet range, fairly thick, will throw easy, not the harder the wood in this case would be the better, but they are fairly disposable, you know, the basic premise for... Well, God, the yo-yo was an original weapon. But anyway, the yo-yo was a weapon. And the boomerang. So, yeah, they're basically just throwing implements, you know. And I have caught rabbit that way before. The throwing stick is the easiest weapon. Just find a branch, you know, and throw it at your target. And you might... Probably not kill it, but you'll definitely like knock it senseless and then you can go, you know, take care of it. That's, I mean, the easiest you can get, you know, for, and then there are lots of variations. Yeah, I mean, not variations on the throwing stick. Well, there are variations on the throwing stick. We just discussed the boomerang and other implements like that. Other, you know, the tomahawk with, I mean, you can cobble it together with modern materials, but yeah, with rock smooth rock. That will be a pain in the ass, by the way. I've seen the primitive technologies guys make one. Other primitive weapons. There are more. Those are the ones that popped to my head right off the bat, though. You know, and like I said, don't underestimate the throwing stick for a survival tool. Maybe I'll make a Kickstarter for that. James's throwing stick, guaranteed to get you the game you need to survive the apocalypse. Only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And it's Kickstarter, so you have to wait a year. I got to manufacture them. I got to find child laborers to make them, to send them to you. It'll take about a year. And then I'm just going to take your money and run to Mexico. Peace out. Food preservation. Hope you guys are having fun with this episode. I am. Food preservation. So the primitives really, really like knew their food preservation because they had to do it. There was not refrigeration. There was not a lot of the modern ways that we will preserve food. And for the most part, there were some advances in food preservation, but most of them are using chemicals to preserve food. Primitives didn't have freeze-dried technology. They didn't have, you know, computer-controlled exact dehydration, you know, and they did not have pressure canners. But, you know, I've seen that there is a freeze dryer for the home now. I haven't really looked into it, but I'm sure it's really, really expensive and probably not the best thing in the world. Usually the first are not the best. It's, you know, revisions and whatnot. But other than that, you know, we as modern people tend to solely rely on the refrigerator and the freezer. And they are great tools whilst the grid is still up. Grid down, that's just gone. So, how did our ancestors preserve food? Smoking was one way. Well, that's weird. There is a threat from my email. Anyway, I bet you guys did hear that. Good job, Avast Antivirus. That is a modern survival skill. Smoking. Smoking, one, makes food taste great. Two, will preserve it. You know, and a lot of the smoke we're talking about will not be hot smoked, not like your brisket that you will eat or your barbecue, but is a cold smoke. So you don't want there to be a lot of heat. You just want the smoke from the fire to cover your meat for hours to preserve it. You know, and this, there will be, I guess, some amount of heat to it, but it will not be a cooking heat. It'll be real slow. And it's just the smoke that's going to get to it. This tends to lend itself real well for fish. Fish can be smoked and preserved for quite a while. Native Americans did it. And there are other meats that lend themselves to smoking. Smoked ham. I'm not going to go terribly deep on that. A lot of these are to give you ideas for things to do, whereas a lot of these individual things could indeed be entire episodes. You know, preparing meat to be cured could indeed be an entire episode, and I will probably do that soon. Yeah. So I definitely tend to think that smoking is best for fish, and for other things. Some things like bacon, because salt cured bacon will last quite a while. The smoke is more for flavor and like added benefit, you know, get a little bit of extra, you know, run for your money there. But is the salt doing the majority of the work in that case? And that doesn't need refrigeration. So salt cured bacon, salt. Salt is something you definitely want to have a good amount of. And it's about time for me to restock my supplies. I, at one point I had 100 pounds of salt and now I'm probably down to about 15 or so. I know I'm damn near out. But I went to the store one time and they had 25 pound bags of rock salt on clearance for a dollar a piece or something. And I was like, well, I need all of those. So I bought them all. You know, it was like 75 pounds of salt. And they're like, well, what are you gonna use all this for? And I was like, I like salt. I was, you know, because people are like, that's crazy. Why would you buy that much salt? And I was like, well, yeah, whatever. You know, it's to preserve a whole deer if I need to. But salt, you can salt pretty much all meat to make it last. Obviously, usually I would suggest trimming the fat off of your meat to preserve it. Fat tends to go rancid quicker, it tends to be the part of the meat that will go rancid, unfortunately, because I like fat. But if not all of it will go bad. Like, I've made homemade jerky before, and you know, and it's perfectly fine. But the fat gets that disgusting waxy texture that's makes it super unappealing. So, in these cases, I would suggest that you want to salt cure your lean meats. But like I said, this is going to be an entire show topic. This curing of foods, this preserving of foods. I don't want to go way too in the weeds because we're only like halfway through and we're at 37 minutes. So salt curing, that's one way. Dehydrating. Native Americans and primitive peoples, they didn't really have dehydrators like we do today. But, you know, if you can dehydrate on racks over a fire, you don't want a rip-roaring fire. You kind of want, one, a lot of smoke and some heat coming up off of it. And the smoke will keep the bugs off, the flies. There's that. Biltong, which is a South African meat, that is really tasty. And that is traditionally it was just hung up, you know, in the shade in trees. I've hung it up just in my apartment when I had my apartment, just strung it up and put it up there. Some people build biltong boxes. Some people do other stuff. One, you don't want to hang it up outside in a humid climate. If you live in Florida, you're listening to this show, you're like, fuck, I'm going to go make some biltong right now. It's going to go rancid. Here in Tennessee, if we hung it up outside with our like daily 60 to 80% humidity, or recently 100% humidity, basically, yeah, it's just going to go bad. If you live in a really dry climate, Arizona, hey Arizona, you should be making biltong. This would be the thing for you. And you'll just have to look up how to make it. It's like jerky, but it's more of a dry pickling. And you just hang it up for a few days. The inside tends to stay fairly moist. I was like, it's kind of like jerky, but it's really kind of not like jerky. It's biltong. I mean, it's a meat that is not, that it's different. And, you should make some. I mean, I've had commercial biltong that I got from a company, and it was nothing like homemade biltong. And because they have to follow some rules and regulations of the FDA, it tended to be a bit more like jerky, but a lot more moist. It had some really great flavors. Homemade biltong is a lot thicker. I mean, like quarter inch strips or so. Like, if you're a jerky maker and you're hearing this, you're like, wow, that's, you know, you're damn near just curing strips of steak, basically. And it's delicious. How am I running long on a solo episode? I don't understand this. I haven't even got to the high-tech survival. So, yeah. Smoking, curing, pickling. Pickling isn't, and that biltong tends to kind of fall in the pickling category. That was another ancient way to preserve vegetables. Fermenting. Fermenting. I was trying to think while doing this. I was like, how do you preserve vegetables? And I was like, oh, yeah, well. And we didn't even talk about larding for the meat, where you basically just have your meat in a jar, a container, vessel, and you cover it with liquid fat. And then it dries, and the liquid fat keeps all of the bacteria and oxygen out to keep from spoiling your food. And larding will last for a pretty long time. And pickling. Pickling and sauerkrauten. Sauerkrauten. Fermenting is a good way to preserve your vegetables. Besides that, I mean, root cellar. A root cellar is a definite way to keep your vegetables, especially your root vegetables, your potatoes, your tubers, your sweet potatoes, squashes, carrots, all of that root cellar. Modern survival. You guys can tell I have some quite affinity for the primitive skills. A lot of them tend to be really fun to do, and I think they are a part of us as humans. So, and there are a lot, some of them can be quite a bit cheaper to get into than the modern high-tech survival, which tends to be fancy smancy and expensive. Especially if you go down the ultralight hole, that's a steep rabbit hole, and you'll spend all of your monies, and then you'll start like, you'll be like a crackhead for gear. You'll be a gear whore, and you won't have no money, and you're still in fucking VCRs trying to get another pack, dudes. Yeah, but some of the ultralight gear, clothing, and equipment is just amazing. And the advances they make with the technology there tend to trickle down. You know, like, you're finding, like, Gore-Tex and Polartec stuff, like, one, if you're really lucky, I've found it a few times at, like, thrift stores and stuff, you know, or it eventually will trickle down to, you know, the Walmart brands and, you know, the store brands or whatever. Like, you'll find cheaper variations eventually, and sometimes you'll find Chinese knockoffs, and sometimes they are worth the price. I said worth the price. You're paying a lot less. They usually will last not as long, but sometimes you'll be surprised and just get some great things. I had the story again. I had a Chinese made K-bar knockoff Tonto knife, and I got it for $25 at a gun show, and I didn't inspect it well enough to see the tiny little markings on it that said made in China or just China. And I was like, when I saw that after I'd, you know, got home and used, you know, like really, really checked it out. Cause when I saw, you know, K-bar $25, I'm like, shut up and take my money. And, I found out it was Chinese, and I was like, well, I'm going to break you. And, you know, from that point, I went batoning and using it to chop trees, using it to chop down a tree. You know, I basically batoned through it sideways to, you know, cut a tree down. batoned everything I could. You know, it hit the dirt. I think I dug in the ground. Couldn't break it. Didn't lose an edge. Didn't lose an edge all this time. Didn't deform the edge. I'm like, I'm sorry, but this is just the best $25 I spent. So good. So with modern things, you can take your shelter with you. You know, earlier we were talking about the primitive shelters and the fun of building them. Well, modern, you know, there are a lot of advances in shelter technology, hammocks and tents and teepees and all the other modern shelters, still nylon tarps that you can make shelters with. And, you know, you have a shelter with you. Some of them are becoming incredibly easy to put together. You know, like the old canvas tents, you know, they were a pain in the ass and you'd probably be a few hours setting it up. You know, a modern hammock system you can have up in minutes. You know, I've seen someone on YouTube put up a hammock system in less than a minute. It had like the snake skins on it, so you just pulled it out and then you just slap the tree straps up, you clip it to it. You know, and with things like whoopee slings, you can get infinite adjustability. I love hammocks. That's why I'm focusing on that. I have a tent. And to be honest, I have not used it in years because I became a hammock camper. Probably going to have to pick up a hammock for me and Serenity to go camping. To be honest, I thought about trying to get like a giant tent and then modify it to accept whoopee slings coming out of it so I can hang my hammock in it and still not sleep on the ground. So I might do something like that. Or just maybe one of those pop-up pavilion things, those canopies, and just hang the hammock underneath it to make it even bigger than a rainfly. Or just go buy a giant rainfly. Anyway, some of those tents that they have out now. I mean, one, you can get like a 50-pound, like 100 people tent, not really, but like 10, 12 people tents, which are, some of them are just basically small houses at this point with multiple rooms and stuff, and they may be super complicated to assemble. And maybe not as much. Like I said, they are getting pretty good on now being pretty easy. I've thought about just going to Walmart and getting the kid tent, which is like, it's not actually big enough for me to sleep in, but if you sleep diagonally, corner to corner, it is big enough, and it's easily, you know, one man carryable, and it's bigger space-wise than my Eureka Solo. I have a one-person tent. It can fit in a bug-out bag. It's a little bit on the big side. My hammocks will definitely fit in a bug-out bag. So, yeah, ferro rods. We talked about that a little bit earlier. Ferro rods are a great way to make fire, especially when combined with coconut oil-soaked cotton balls. And I have found that I like coconut oil soaked cotton balls more than I like petroleum jelly soaked cotton balls, because it gives you, it has more purpose. It has more uses. You can use the coconut oil soaked ones. So I like that. You know, you can grease your pot with them and then start your fire. You know, there's just more to it. And coconut oil is amazing. Ferro rods, like I said, they are cheap, and there's just no reason not to have a few of them. I mean, I keep them in all my kits. I have one on my keychain. They're just redundancy. I mean, I also have a lighter on my keychain, so two ways to make fire on my keychain. That's everywhere I go. Fresnel lens. Thank you to the listener who pointed out that I kept saying Fresnel lens because I don't like silly Frenchy words. But Fresnel. Fresnel lens, basically a magnifying glass. You can get these fairly cheap in different sizes. You can get pocket size ones that will more than likely start a fire. I've got like an 8.5 by 11 sheet that will burn wood. You don't even need paper or fire starter. You just catch the wood straight on fire and go to town. It's great. What I like about those is it's pretty much an infinite resource. As long as you have sun, you know, your lens won't get used up. Ferro rod, eventually after so many fires, you will use the entire thing. Same thing with like lighters and whatnot that have a consumable that they use. You'll eventually use them up. So in like the order of starting a fire, I would always say start with your most renewable source and then fall back to your least renewable source for the most part, in a survival situation or whatnot. You know, like right now, I'm going to tell you to make a fire with a lighter. Just use your Bic. You could buy a million of them right now, and they will be around for years. And there's no reason not to. I mean, sometimes people get snobby on like the survival forums. Do people still use survival forums? It looks like most of the ones I used to go to are kind of dried up. Facebook is kind of hopping though, but Facebook is mostly is taken over by spammers. So there's that. Running low on time. I may have to split this. I don't know. But yeah, now I would say use your lighter or use your ferro rod. If the shit hits the fan, then I'm going to tell you to move from the most renewable to the least renewable, which would always be using the sun to start a fire. If there's sun, no sun, then you move to, you know, whatever's easier and easier. And in that case, yeah, just start with the Fresnel lens, move to the ferro rods, and then use your lighter. Because the lighter is pretty much guaranteed surefire. You're going to start a fire with it. I would want to save that for like an emergency, or you've used up the other ones. Like, you know, it's raining, it's cold, I need a fire now, use a lighter. You know, because you're not going to start a fire with a Fresnel lens in the rain. You're not. So yeah, that's my order of that, and they are great, and the learning curve on all of those, it's so much easier than any of the friction fire methods. It may take you months or years to master the hand drill fire. It will take you 2 seconds to master the Bic fire. So, learn it and move on. Modern weapons, there are a lot of them. This is one where the modern weapons far trump the primitive weapons. I mean, the modern trumps the primitive in this one so fold. Guns, we have guns now, and modern guns are amazing. It is, we can't go deep on that. That is many shows of topics, topics on guns. But there's definitely a place to have a battery of guns in your possession to suit different things. I mean, they're not mystical and you know, woo-woo and all that shit. They are tools, and it is best to use the right gun, the right tool for the job. Whereas, you know, the AR-15 is not the best to go hunting with, you know, for most things, depending on what you're doing. I know some people, maybe they even use the AR-10 platform. Some people will hunt wild boar with the AR-15. You know, and I guess that's fun, you know, and with something like that where it's kind of close quarters and they're definitely not being still for you and they have a thick hide, at, you know, in that case, probably not that bad. You don't want to go deer hunting with the AR-15 as an emergency. You probably could, you know, you probably could, but it is not the best tool for the job. You know, I would definitely move to something else. You know, so it is good to have a few guns specifically for their things. If you can only have one gun, you know, it's kind of a toss up between, you know, if you're like, James, I only have so much money right now and I want to get my first gun. What do I get? Probably going to say a shotgun. I was like, maybe a 22 long rifle. 22 ammo is still fairly hard to find. And, you know, I can't tell you you'll get something that you can't even practice and shoot with. So shotgun ammo is plentiful. You can, you know, with different chokes and different, you know, with slugs and different shot, there's a lot of things you can do with it. You can stockpile quite a lot of ammo. So, shotgun, yeah, that's definitely it. And then there's those adapters where you can shoot handgun calibers with the shotgun. So, hands down, get a shotgun. You can grab one from a pawn shop, less than $200. I paid $260 for my Remington 870. So, go buy a shotgun. Pepper spray is a modern marvel. It is definitely one worth having, and I like, and I don't know, there's only so much pocket space, so I've toyed with carrying pocket with pepper spray, but I definitely like the idea of having a less than lethal option available to you instead of immediately going to the handgun or to the your weapon. Then you would have a less than lethal option. The compound bow is a big improvement on the longbow. It's smaller, it's compact, you can shoot really hard with, you know, a smaller frame. So, it's worth having and learning. This past weekend, I went to the Renaissance Fair with Serenity, and there was an archery shooting area. Like, they had all the games, like, you know, most carnivals and fairs. Some of them had, like, medieval slants to them or whatnot, but there was things like axe throwing and arrow shooting and whatnot. And I was like, yeah, how much is that? And they're like, $5 for 12 arrows. And I was like, well, that's you're sold. Here's shut up and take my money. Not the most consistent archer. Ryan on Facebook pointed out that I had my elbow too high, that it was chicken winging or whatever. I was trying to shoot Japanese style, Ryan, not traditional English style where you pull the arrow back more towards your chin, your jawline, and not towards your ear like Japanese style. But this is just in theory because I don't really know how to shoot an arrow, and it was inconsistent. I hit pretty close to the target a few times, not so close to it a few more times. So it got the archery bug in me, and I kind of want to give it a go. So I may make myself a traditional longbow, even though I just said that compound bows are probably better, but I like building stuff. And that's one last thing I want to touch on is The cell phone is a great modern survival tool that you can, like, with apps and whatnot, and with just the built-in stuff on it, is well worth having. GPS is a modern marvel, my friends. And if the grid ever goes down, if EMP hits or whatnot, all of that's going to go out the window. If the satellites fail, then that won't be a thing. But day-to-day now, they work just fine. So there's no reason not to use them now, because at some point they may not work. It's ridiculous. So GPS, and, you know, years ago I would have suggested, you know, like a TomTom or whatnot, but I just don't see the reason now. I mean, they're one of those things that, like, you have a GPS in your pocket. So the cell phone it is, my friends. There are a lot of cool new devices to keep your devices charged. I'm a fan of the PowerPot, which you boil water in it, and it uses that thermoelectric energy to convert, or uses that thermal energy to convert to electric energy to charge your devices. It's a little slow, but it's just keeping the fire going, boiling the water, like it's whatever, you know. So there's that. I use the Solio solar panel charger. It works. You know, I've using that and some other things, I've managed to keep a cell phone charged off the grid for a week or so. It worked. I think that about wraps it up. There are probably things I forgot on the modern technologies. We didn't even really get into clothing, which, you know, like traditional, you have like your wool and fur to keep you warm. Modern, you know, Gore-Tex, polar fleece, all that stuff. Really great materials. So that could be a whole episode too. But yeah, that's high-tech survival versus primitive survival. You know, and it wasn't super in-depth, but it should have given you a few ideas. And, like, you know, I probably want to start flint napping, you know, or we didn't talk about communication. But, you know, it should have been a fun thing. If you have thoughts on it, please go to the blog and leave a comment, survivalpunk.com. You can also find me on Facebook on Survival Punk on the page, or the Survival Punk Punks as a Facebook group. The group is a lot more interactive, a lot more fun. It's kind of like an online forum. There's a lot of sharing going on there. So, and the episodes are posted there, and you can also discuss them there. So do check that out. Thanks for listening. Don't forget that there is the Survival Punk Army. If you like what you hear, consider joining the Survival Punk Army and help support the show. Every little bit helps, and I appreciate it. And with that, DIY to build primitive shelter, you guys.